It was 25 years ago that the world's attention turned to Iowa when a crippled DC-10 with nearly 300 passengers crash-landed outside of Sioux City.
United 232, have you understand you're going to try to make it into Sioux City? There's no airports out that way that can accommodate you, sir.
Okay, we'll head for Sioux City. We got a little bit of control back now.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we recall that crash of a fully loaded jumbo jet in July of 1989 with author Lawrence Gonzalez. His new book is titled Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. Miraculously, 184 of the 296 passengers and crew lived. We'll also talk this hour with two of the surviving flight attendants, Jan Brown and Susan White. Remembering the last flight of United 232 after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On the afternoon of July 19, 1989, the passengers of United Airlines Flight 232 en route from Denver to Chicago were watching a video about the Kentucky Derby and finishing up a lunch of chicken fingers and cherries when a loud explosion split the silence. The DC-10 lurched violently, and a few minutes later, one of the pilots announced that they had lost an engine, but they would still be able to continue to Chicago with the two remaining engines. Then it became clear that Sioux City was all the farther they would be able to make it.
Sioux City, got a emergency for you. All right. I got a United aircraft coming in, lost number two engine, having a hard time controlling the aircraft right now. He's at a 29,000 right now in descent into Sioux City right now. He's to your VOR, but he wants the equipment standing by right now.
Radar contact.
Okay, so you know we have almost no controllability. Very little elevator and almost no aileron. We're controlling the turns by power. I don't think we can turn right, but I think we can only make left turns. Well, we're starting a little bit of a left turn right now. I mean, we can only turn right. We can't turn left.
Then, 44 minutes after that initial explosion, the jumbo jet carrying 296 passengers crashed into a runway in Sioux City. It broke into pieces and burst into flames as it slid into an adjacent cornfield. Miraculously, 184 of the 296 passengers and crew lived. Joining us this hour, two of the crew who survived, as well as the author of a new in-depth book about the catastrophe. Lawrence Gonzalez has done exhaustive research on this topic, extensive interviews with most involved on that day, air traffic controllers, rescue workers, the survivors, pilots, flight attendants. He is the author of Surviving Survival and Deep Survival. His latest book is titled Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. Lawrence Gonzalez joins us by phone. Hello, Lawrence.
How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for joining us today. And we have with us, we're so glad to have with us, Jan Brown is with us, a survivor of that flight and the chief flight attendant. Jan Brown, welcome.
Oh, good afternoon, Ben. Thank you.
Good afternoon to you. Another flight attendant, Susan White Callender, is with us. Susan, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Both of your stories, your amazing stories, feature prominently in Lawrence's new book. It is riveting reading that I've been enjoying the last few days. And we want to reach out to our listeners and say, as you can guess, the nature of today's program may bring up some graphic descriptions of the crash scene. If that's not something for you, here's your chance to tune out for the next hour. Let me start with you, Lawrence. We heard a little bit of the audio there. What was going on in the cockpit? What did the pilots experience in the first moments after that explosion?
Well, their first reaction was, we lost an engine. We know how to do this. We'll just shut it down and we'll go on to Chicago on the two engines that are hanging on the wings. The engine that failed is the one through the tail. But then the aircraft started to roll over to the right, and as Al Haynes put it, roll over on its back. And it went into a very, very steep bank, and the first officer, not Al Haynes, but Bill Records, was flying the plane at that point and tried to turn left to correct the roll to the right. And he's pulling back on the control column, and he's turning left, and nothing's happening. And he says, Al, I can't control the airplane. And Haynes grabbed the controls, and he too tried to do that. And the plane's still rolling and rolling and rolling. And Jan Brown saw part of this happening. And so Al Haynes reached over, and he advanced the throttle for the engine on the right wing all the way forward and retarded the throttle for the engine on the left wing all the way back. And that extra power on the right side gradually brought that wing back up and essentially Al Haynes at that moment saved everyone's life because that plane was going down.
So, and I want to talk to Jan in just a moment to get what that was like. But there was more than an engine out. The engine had taken out a major system used for controlling, which was the hydraulics, right?
Right. The engine exploded, and pieces of it went in every direction, and they went through the tail and cut the hydraulic lines. So what at first seemed just like an engine failure quickly represented a complete loss of steering for the plane.
So he was steering. He found a way very quickly to steer with just the thrust of those two engines.
Yes, and when I talked to Al Haynes, I said, how come you did that? It wasn't in your training. And he said, I know. I have no idea why I did it. And to this day, he doesn't know why he did it. He acted from gut instinct as a very experienced pilot that this was the only thing that was going to save the day.
Jan Brown is a chief flight attendant there. You were up and had a chance to go into the cockpit right after the explosion. What did you observe?
Well, it was several minutes after the explosion. I sat down on the floor and just held on because I didn't know if it was decompression. And we're taught to protect ourselves first so that we can protect everybody else. But by the time they called me up to the cockpit, several minutes had passed. And when they opened the door, I just knew that this wasn't just your everyday emergency. It was a huge crisis.
What did you see specifically that made you so worried?
It was more what was in the air. Just an awareness of the crisis just filled the air. I stepped into the cockpit. Everything was normal in that there was no panic or anything. It was just that they were, both Al and Bill were both trying to control the airplane.
So they're wrestling with the controls.
And, well, you could just see the strength that was on the way they were holding. I could see it in their arm. Both their arms were in identical positions holding the yoke, and you could feel that there was tremendous tension and force going into that.
What were your thoughts at that moment?
I think part of me just froze over to consume the fear because I realized that this was a situation because Al had said that we had lost all hydraulics. So at that point, they knew the situation that thus far. And what losing all hydraulics meant to us was that, the brakes wouldn't work when we landed. But as we were banking to the right and I looked down and guesstimated that we were probably at 37,000 feet, I thought the situation was such that we could go straight down.
Susan White Callender, where were you when the explosion happened in those minutes after that?
I was right at door four, right underneath the engine, and I had my arms filled with sodas and soft drink or milk to replenish the cart for the last four rows. And as soon as I heard the explosion, I went down on the ground and held on to my jump seat, which was right there at four left, to protect myself. And I thought a bomb went off until I looked around. And I thought, who put a bomb on the plane? And I didn't see any holes or anything flying around that it would be a decompression.
And what was the conversations going on? You're there you have your own fears, but you have the fears of a lot of people, right, Susan?
Right. Oh, yes, yes. And then after we went back in the aisle, after the announcement that we were going to continue to Chicago, but we were going to fly to lower altitude and we were going to be a little late, this lady said to me, she said, what about my connection? I have a connection in Chicago. And I was still shaking at the time. And I said, oh, don't worry about that. We'll deal with that when we get there, thinking, oh, my goodness, this was a loud explosion. And, you know, a lot of people were nervous about it. But we still had to, you know, continue on our job and try to be professional, even though inside I was shaking.
Okay, I want to play a little bit more of the audio here. And Lawrence, you can perhaps tell us a little bit about this audio and how the stage at which Sioux City was selected here. Let's listen to a little bit more of the conversation.
232, we're going to try to put it in Sioux City.
United 232, have you understand you're going to try to make it into Sioux City? There's no airports out that way that can accommodate you, sir.
Okay, we'll head for Sioux City. We got a little bit of control back there. Only the runway.
United 232 heavy. The airport, the runway is 9,000 feet long, 150 foot wide.
Okay, Lawrence, what's happening there?
Well, so they were out east of Sioux City on their way to Chicago when the engine blew up, and they were circling to the right because they couldn't turn left. There was a big hole in the right side of the engine cowling where the engine had blown up, and it was acting like a paddle in the water, if you can picture that. It was just dragging the plane around to the right, and they were just fighting to keep the plane from rolling over and diving into the ground. So while they're doing that, they're thinking, where can we land this thing? And the air traffic controller is saying there's nothing out there. You can't land on any of those airports. They're too small. So Sioux City quickly becomes the best option because they have a 9,000-foot runway. It's an Air National Guard base, and they had fighter planes there that were landing on these long runways. And it's a big north-south runway. So they were discussing the options, and that's why he asked how long is it, because he knew he had a jumbo jet in his hands and he had to have a lot of runway. The first voice on that tape is Bill Records, the first officer, and the second voice is Al Haynes.
Now, it did end up being the Sioux City Airport. Let's talk a little bit about what was going on in the ground, and then I want to talk a little bit about what's going on in the air with our flight attendants. Tell us, there was a great scramble for rescue workers. What was happening in these? They had about a half an hour, right, Lawrence?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. So by the time the airplane called an emergency, and so the tower was informed there's an emergency going on, and they listened for a while, and they realized this is not a play emergency. This is a very serious emergency. And so they called an alert 3, which is the maximum alert the airport can have. It means either a plane has crashed or a plane is about to crash. And that calls emergency equipment from all over the area. I believe there were 80 pieces of equipment from 40 communities or something like that. I can't remember the exact numbers, but the highways all around there lit up with flashing lights as people started converging. And because Sioux City is an Air National Guard base, they had hundreds of Air National Guard people there ready to help as well. So everybody in the entire area began mobilizing to assist with this crash before it ever happened. And people started gathering on the field. The hospitals began gearing up. They had the halls lined with gurneys and emergency equipment ready to take the injured in. And the whole community, it was just an amazing effort. There was a group that started making sandwiches. They made 700 sandwiches for emergency use for the people who would be there helping. And all the while, the crew in the cockpit is fighting to keep this plane aloft.
Jan Brown, tell us more about what's happening on board at this time. You have 30, 40 minutes after the explosion. You have a good half an hour to contemplate what's going to happen. What are you doing in this time to prepare yourself and the passengers?
Well, I guess my plan started as soon as I came out of the cockpit, and I made a quick prayer, could I be somewhere else, and got a very quick response, no. And so my first thought was, well, I have to pull myself together, and I have to be calm, and my crew has to be calm, which I had great faith in. We'd been working together for 4 days, and we have to keep the passengers calm. And with that thought, I knew I couldn't call all of my crew together to brief them, so I would just go to where they were so as not to alert the passengers, because I had learned in the past that when it goes bump in the night, passengers immediately look to flight attendants to see if they can read what the problem is. And I just wanted to hold off to keep the truth from them until we absolutely needed to do that when we did the emergency preparation.
Susan White Callender, what do you remember about giving instruction to your set of passengers and toward the back of the plane, right?
Yes. I was standing at door 3, and when Jan started reading from the book for our emergency preparation, there was a gal that was young, and she was a few rows back on the right, and she began sobbing hysterically. And I thought, I need to go calm this woman, and I was afraid everyone else was going to start crying. And so I went over to this young lady, and I reached over the man on the aisle, and I hugged her, and she just was crying and crying and saying, are we going to die? Are we going to die? I can't die. I have small children at home. They need me. And are we going to die? And at that moment, I truly felt we might die, and I couldn't lie to her and say, no, everything's going to be fine. But I didn't want to, of course, tell her, you know, this is, you know, we possibly could die. And so I just told her that we needed to pray and we needed to be prepared for the hard landing, as the captain explained in the announcement he had just made.
And we have to take a short break. We'll be back with Lawrence Gonzalez, author of the book Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. We're recalling the afternoon of July 19th, 1989, when a fully loaded jumbo jet crash-landed in Sioux City. Also with us, two survivors from that crash, flight attendants Susan Callender-White and Jan Brown. We'll be back with Jan, Susan, and Lawrence Gonzalez. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. More of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we're recalling the afternoon of July 19th, 1989, when a jumbo jet, a DC-10 carrying 296 passengers, crashed into a runway in Sioux City at that airport, broken to pieces, burst into flames as it slid into an adjacent cornfield. Miraculously, 184 of the 296 passengers and crew lived. We're talking this hour with two survivors, chief flight attendant on that flight, Jan Brown, also flight attendant Susan White Callender. So grateful to have them talk about what must be a very painful memory following them through their life since that time. Lawrence Gonzalez with us as well, author of a new book, in-depth, exhaustive, riveting book with extensive interviews with most of the people who were involved that day. Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. So now we come to the point of the crash. Lawrence, I wanted to, one of the things that struck me about your book, the phenomenal response on the ground you mentioned already, but the professional work of these pilots under such stress. Let me play a clip of the pilot. This is a pilot knowing he's going to crash land in a few minutes, actually with a bit of joking at the end of this. And I think it's just amazing. Let's listen to it. He's talking to a man in a flight in a tower.
United 232, heavy, Roger. And advise when you get the airport in sight.
Got a runway in sight. We'll be with you very shortly. Thanks a lot for your help.
United 232, heavy. The wind's currently 360 at 11. 360 at 11. You're cleared to land on any runway.
You want to be particular and make it a runway, huh?
You want to be particular and make it a runway, huh? Who was that?
It was Al Haynes. Al had an amazing sense of humor throughout this whole thing, and I think it played a role in keeping him calm. At one point, he says, "Hey, we didn't try this on my last check ride," just he keeps making these cracks like that right to the very end. He's an amazing guy.
It's the way he copes with it, the incredible stress.
Yeah.
Before we go to our survivors and ask their experiences, tell us when the plane did hit the ground, and we have a link to the crash, a video of that, on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. Explain what happened to the aircraft when it crash-landed.
So it was coming in fairly stable, and if you watch that video, you can see this. And at the last minute, the right wing dropped, and we don't know why the right wing dropped, but it did, and it hit the runway, broke the main spar, tore off that engine, and the landing gear broke off, and the strut went into the concrete and tore a huge hole in the concrete. As that was happening, the left wing's still flying, the left engine's still going, so it rises up and up and up, and it goes on its nose, and the plane actually bounced on its nose several times. And as it bounced, it pirouetted around 360 degrees. On the second bounce, I believe, the cockpit was scuffed off and thrown away with these four guys inside of it. The next bounce, first class was crushed. A lot of people were killed, and first class was torn off. And meanwhile, it's rotating around. And then it finally goes over on its back and slides into a cornfield. And that bouncing on the nose absorbed a lot of energy that protected the people in the coach cabins.
Jan Brown, recall what you remember from the seconds right up to the crash until you were out of the aircraft.
Yes, well, I can't forget smashing into the earth the way we did, even though Al had prepared us or told us to prepare ourselves for it. You just can't imagine hitting with such immense force. And I thought I saw an overhead bin open up, and I, after trying to look normal for 40 minutes, I just lost consciousness. I think it saved my life because as we were rolling over, which I definitely did not want to do, I'm not a roller coaster rider or Ferris wheel. So I at first was going to resist and then just went with it and went to a deep unconscious state.
What did you remember after you came to? The first thing?
Before that, I was in fire. So I sort of said, well, this is it. This is how I'm going to go. I couldn't imagine surviving that. And then suddenly the fire was gone and we stopped. And I remember thinking, I was just amazed that I was still thinking. In other words, I was still alive. And then it just kicked in that if I'm alive, we're getting out of here.
And you found a lot of accounts of people in darkness. Did you see light?
Well, it was, I thought I was working my release. It's a rotating dial. And I was getting frustrated because it wasn't releasing. And I heard a male voice, which turned out to be one of my helper passengers that was sitting diagonally across from me, say, can I help you? And I told him I couldn't get my release. He later told me my hand was just brushing over it. And little did he know that when he pushed me up out of the weight of the shoulder harness and rotated the dial that it was going to fly off. So I apparently fell on him.
And the plane is inverted, so the ceiling is actually where the seats are, and you fell out of one of those.
I fell out of my jump seat.
Mm-hmm.
And he said I jumped to my feet and was yelling, get out, which I don't remember saying, but it was pitch dark, and I knew that airplane in the dark, but it was like waking up on an alien planet. Nothing was recognizable. I wasn't fully aware that we were upside down now and that the floor was the ceiling and vice versa. So I was looking for light.
And you found...
Light meant getting... And I heard somebody behind me say that there was light, and so I immediately went there, and it was an opening, and cables and all manner of equipment were hanging, and I was holding it all aside. People were walking off, and I could have been saying thank you for flying with us today. It was so surreal.
And then you finally reach the outside where it's a beautiful summer day in Iowa.
Well, when the people had seemed to have stopped coming and getting out, and I was thinking of going back in further and looking for any survivors, the smoke was coming towards me. It was like a tornado, except it was roiling along the floor ceiling that I was forced to leave the wreckage. And it was a beautiful day.
Susan White Callender, recall the moment of impact and how you escaped the wreckage.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I had basically prepared myself to die. And right before landing, I was completely calm and looking out at the fluffy clouds going by so fast. And I had just said, okay, Lord, I'm in your hands. And immediately, I felt like we just dropped and hit. It was so hard. And a big, huge ball of fire. And I calmly said to myself, I'm burning to death. That's how I'm dying. And then we flipped up, and it was loud and screeching, and there was debris that was flying everywhere. Pieces of metal started ripping apart from the cabin. And I just remember it being loud. I put my hands up over my head. I had my legs up in the air. I thought the carts were going to come out of that back galley and crush me. And I went from thinking I was dying to survival mode. Now I'm going to survive. Hang on, hang on. I kept saying, protect yourself. At one moment, there was a piece of metal that cut open my thigh and my butt right through my pants, and it cut my shoe open. And I just kept knocking things out of the way and keeping my eyes open. And it was like a battle back there. And we were just tumbling around so fast. And all of a sudden then the bathroom doors came open. We locked the bathroom doors on landing, and it could hear the tanks swishing around, and some of the blue water, the toilet water, started spewing out at me. And I had a funny moment in all that terror. I thought, oh my gosh, I wonder how many people went to the bathroom in there, and I don't care what hits me as long as I survive. And then I kept thinking, well, what moment is something going to come slice my head off, because it was so violent. I felt like we were on an old rickety roller coaster, and it was a tornado at the same time because it was so violent. And all of a sudden, we just stopped, and it was silent, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm alive. And I started yelling our commands that we're taught, release your seatbelts and get out. And the second time around, I heard Donna yelling, the other flight attendant, and I was up on the top. So the plane was almost on its side, the tail, and I had no idea that we had broken off from the rest of the aircraft. I thought the only reason we were tumbling around, that the wings were off, and that's where the soot was all coming in. I had no idea it was 2 to 3 rows behind me or in front of my jump seat. And so we were up on the ceiling. I was on the ceiling, and I was kept yelling to release your seatbelt and get out. And I was looking around thinking, where's the fire? Where's the fire? The fire was right there. Are we going to explode? And I couldn't get my seatbelt unfastened. And we had two types of buckle harnesses. One was, you know, entire circle, and the other was a little wing release. And I looked down after struggling for a few seconds, and I said, oh, and I had the wrong one. I released it, and I had to hold on to my one harness, and I swung around. I looked up, and my door was up on the ceiling now, up on top. So I thought, there's no use opening the door. The door is probably going to come in. The slide pack would come in at me. And that's when I looked around, and I saw the big gaping hole. And there were only a few rows. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this is happening, and that we are the tail, and where's the rest of the airplane?
You were away from the fire where the rest of the airplane had the fire.
Yes, yes. So the only fire that was the initial impact. That's where I saw the fire. And then I had no idea that we had rolled away. So there wasn't any fire at that point. And it was, you know, you could see it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So it was just like being on the plane without lights on. There was still daylight and you could see everything because of the big gaping hole right there. And then I had to put my one leg on side of my jump seat, and I swung my other leg around to there's a divider that had magazine rack and the emergency equipment. And I was looking down, and there was a man trapped, and I saw a little boy run, and I saw another couple run. And I tried to reach down and pull up this metal because this man was trapped under it. And for me to get out, I had to jump on that metal and then jump down again. So I couldn't get out until this man got out. And he was struggling, and he said, I can't get out. And I told him to wiggle. And so he wiggled and he got out. And the minute he got out, I jumped down on the metal and jumped again. And Donna, the other flight attendant at Four Right, she came from underneath at the exact same time. And we kind of went to run, and I looked back. I could hear people, and I saw there was still a man and a boy that were hanging in their seats. And I said, Donna, we need to go back in. There's still people in the plane. So she and I went back in, and, you know, I kept thinking it was going to explode at this point. And we yelled up to them to release their seatbelt and get out. And he said, we'll fall. And I said, release your boy's seatbelt. We'll catch him. And so he reached over and released the boy's seatbelt, and we caught his fall, and then the man got out.
Mm. Amazing. And there you were in that July, sunny July day in a cornfield near Sioux City. Susan White Callender, Jan Brown, two surviving flight attendants from Flight 232, July 19th, 1989, crash landing with 296 passengers and 184 of them surviving. Lawrence Gonzalez with us as well. His new book, Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival. Unfortunately, we're running out of time a little bit. Lawrence, let me have you, because this is a really important part of your book, briefly touch on the fact of the response on the ground. When the plane hit the ground, you describe many rescuers watching this fireball tumbling down the runway into the cornfield. Those in the tower, other rescuers thought, that's it. There are no survivors, right?
Yeah. Yes. That's what the reaction was among most people. And once they began approaching the field, this changed rapidly. One Air National Guardman was in a truck with a couple of others, and they drove out onto the runway, and there were banks of seats lying across the runway with dead people in them. And as they sat watching, these people started to get up and unbuckle their seatbelts and walk across the concrete. And this guy, whose name was Jim Walker, said, "Are you all seeing what I'm seeing? Can you believe this?" And some of the people whose seats had been torn out of the plane and had tumbled down the runway at 200 miles an hour or better actually walked away, some injured, some not injured, but right among the dead people.
And the response, you really have to read this book to get the enormous response, the pride that Iowa should rightly feel, and that part of Iowa should feel. Susan White Callender, you must have a special feeling for Iowa based on that response.
Oh, my goodness. I'm from Iowa. Every time when I'm flying and I meet someone on my plane from Iowa, I just want to thank them, and I tell them how wonderful the people were to us that day, and they're very special to me.
Lawrence, there's a quote in your book from the Airline Pilots Association. This accident was never supposed to have happened.
Yeah.
Explain briefly what that meant, because it ties into what was determined as the cause.
That meant that this airplane was designed and certified by the Federal Aviation Administration in such a way that any malfunction should be controllable by the pilots. So their certification for that aircraft depended on them guaranteeing that no single malfunction could disable the airplane, and that's exactly what happened. So the DC-10 had a deep flaw in it that everybody knew about, and it was just ignored.
Mm. Jan Brown, as we finish up here, you've spent the last 25 years campaigning for regulations for children under 2 in aircraft. How does that tie into this crash?
Well, we should have learned that we shouldn't have lap children. If passengers have to stow their laptops, what are we doing with our lap children? Flight attendants have no recourse in a situation. And certainly ours was one of the extremes, but turbulence happens every day, and parents just are not aware that no matter how much they love that child, they can't hold them in severe G-force situations.
And what was your experience on board this aircraft? Children, babies, you had to tell them to parents to not hold their child, to what, put them on the floor and wrap them in blankets?
Well, the crew had had given pillows and blankets out to buffer the children. And then my announcement was to parents to place them on the floor and hold them. But it suddenly was, my goodness, this sounds great in a classroom situation, but it's the most ludicrous thing I've ever said in a lifetime.
And you knew at that time it was ludicrous.
Oh, it was horrendous. It was like, this isn't a situation to just hope for the best. But that's all we had. And it was one particular mother that I kept meeting from the beginning of the explosion. I went to her as soon as we had stabilized and comforted her. She was starting to panic, and I told her, as I heard the announcement that we'd lost an engine, that we had two engines, that we'd be all right. And then she was one of the first people I met when I had to leave the wreckage. She was trying to, I knew she was going back to look for her child, this beautiful 22-month-old boy that was seated on her lap.
Did she find him?
No, I stopped her from going back because that deadly smoke had driven me from the wreckage. I couldn't let her go back, so I told her what I thought would stop her. I told her that rescue workers would find him. She looked up at me and she said, I told her to put her baby on the floor, and she did, and he's gone. And I started getting some feeling back at that point. So that's what inspires me. His voice isn't here to say that it's not safe for small children to be held on laps on metal tubes going over 500 miles an hour. And the FAA just refuses to do it because, as noted in other situations, they usually wait until there's a death count. They can't be bothered with the rules and the rulemaking, as they told me.
Susan White Callender, how did this experience of survival change you?
Oh, my gosh. I think as everyone else has been in a situation like that, you really have an appreciation of life and your family and friends, and you just don't take that for granted anymore.
Mm-hmm. Lawrence Gonzalez, what do you want readers to take away from this story? So much that we couldn't cover in this hour of conversation that is in your book, Flight 232. What an amazing read, an amazing experience. You have covered so many catastrophes, crises that people have somehow survived, all kinds of them, in your writing, in your work. What sets this apart, and what's to be taken away?
It's just the soaring, amazing resilience of the human spirit that you get out of this book. You see people giving their lives for others. One man, businessman, draped his body over a 9-year-old boy and saved the boy's life, and it cost him his life. They were, in fact, right across the plane from Susan White. You see people staying inside the burning plane to help others out, and you get a renewed faith in humanity. These people, and you mentioned the people of Sioux City, or Siouxland, as the bigger area is called, these people just would do anything to help you. And it was just a tremendously moving experience to know that that's out there in the world today.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly, there must have been some very tough interviews here with the survivors.
Yes, yes. Many, many people broke down and cried during the interviews, and I did too. I mean, it was an extremely moving experience, and I want to say that writing the book was kind of like being on the plane. You know, you can get on, but you can't get off. And that was my I hope that's people's experience reading it, too. You can get on, but you can't get off.
Jan, Susan, what do you think of Lawrence's book?
I think it's incredible the way he's researched and put all the pieces together and explained the story to tell it for everyone.
Jan, you too?
He's found the heart of the matter, and I would like to hats off to Sioux City again. As I've said for 25 years, what an amazing community.
Absolutely.
Jan Brown, chief flight attendant on that flight 232 in 1989. Susan White Callender, flight attendant, thank you so much to give your firsthand account of survival. Lawrence Gonzalez, thank you. Flight 232, A Story of Disaster and Survival, is the title of Lawrence Gonzalez's latest book. Thank you, Lawrence.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions. In fact, why not on our Facebook, share your memories of that day. It's one of those days we all remember. Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.